Picture number seven.
Colonel Hancock, Reel 10. Could you tell me something about your duties at Stourton Barracks?
Yes, I was responsible for placing the men who were stationed at the barracks, to placing the men on farms where they were needed for various jobs. They were taken out in army lorries and given the necessary tools and so on to help the farmers. And I had the use of a car which I was allowed to hire from a local garage to get from farm to farm to see if all was going well. And that in itself, being allowed to go tell about the motor car, was quite a luxury for me, because I'd never had much opportunity of that kind of thing. Anyway, that was a jolly well worth thing, a wild thing, because that period, I think it was at that period when the submarine menace was very, very real. A tremendous lot of shipping was being sunk, and we were fighting for our existence. And I felt this was such a good thing to be able to help in providing a certain amount of food for the country.
Did you get much time free?
Yes, well, after perhaps 5 or 6 o'clock at night, almost, occasionally, perhaps a half day, I used to go to London occasionally. And I remember on one occasion, I missed the last train back from London to Guildford, and all I could get was a train from Waterloo to Woking. Well, I thought I'd better get as far as that anyhow. I got to be on parade next day. So I went down as far as Woking, got out on the platform, and I'd been told there was no train that went on to Guildford. However, I spoke to the engine driver, and I said, is there no train at all going on from here to Guildford? Because I don't fancy trying to walk there, even if I could. He said, no, no more train, but I'm taking this engine down to the loco sheds in Guildford. If you like, I'll give you a lift on the footplate. So I said, thankful. Anyway, I got on board. It wasn't not a very long journey. And he very obligingly stopped his engine on an embankment quite close to the barracks. And I got out and scrambled down. I said, thanks very much. That was jolly kind of you. And that was it. Got into barracks, but I didn't say anything about this for some little time. I thought I'd better not. However, some time later on, I thought the commandant, Colonel Pickard, might be amused to hear about this. So I told him what had happened. He didn't think it looked at all funny. I think he'd forgotten what it was like to be young.
Where were you posted from Stourton Barracks at the end of the summer?
Now, Stourton Barracks, I may have gone back. I may have gone back to the training battalion at Halton, or the training battalion might by then have been sent to Crowborough. That was my next recollection, is that I joined the training battalion again, and they were then at Crowborough. We had quite nice camp there. We did the normal kind of training of recruits or rehabilitating those who'd been passed as A1, getting them ready for drafts to go abroad.
I'd like to pick up on an incident that happened actually earlier. You were awarded a wound gratuity. Could you describe that?
That was rather a funny little thing. I one day, there was, when I was back in hospital, I think, at maybe in Denmark Hill, somewhere, one of those places. Oh no, at one time I was at the First Eastern General at Cambridge. That was a place, I think it might have been from there. there when I was there having special electrical treatment, I remember on one occasion. Anyway, I one day got a warrant sent from the War Office for some peculiar, odd sort of sum. It was about £132.17 and 6 something like that. Can't remember what it was. Anyway, I thought this would be marvellous. I cashed it, and I used to go about with money in my pocket. I felt like a blooming millionaire. I never had so much money in my life. And it wasn't very long before it had gone, almost. And then, a bit later on, I got another warrant, also for a peculiar sum, odd sum. And I found the two added together came up to £250. And that, I had to inquire about it. I don't know why I got it. I was told that was a wound good shirt here.
Did everybody get this?
Well, I think so. Yes, I think so. I think it depended upon how serious your wound was. I imagine by the time that you were in hospital, whether you were likely to be permanently disabled or what. But I must say, I said, thank you very much indeed. I didn't ask why they had sent him in. I thought that might be a little risky to ask any questions.
You also received the MC. Can you remember anything about the ceremony when King George gave it to you?
Yes, I can. I think it was round about that time. I know I was in hospital at the time. It might have been Denmark Hill. I think it was. Yes, I think it was. I got a notification from the War Office to say that I'd been awarded the military cross and I was to attend an investiture at Buckingham Palace on a certain day. And I remember the day, it was a Tuesday, and I'd regarded Tuesday as my lucky day ever since the day I was evacuated from Gallipoli. Anyway, I got myself there, and there were quite a number of being invested with various decorations, and all I can remember is asking for a chair if I could sit down because my leg was aching, and then going into the presence of King George V, and I remember his pinning the medal on my jacket and shaking hands with me, and that was that. And I went out in a kind of a trance. It was a wonderful experience.
Did you feel that when you got your MC, were you proud to have won the MC, or did you think it came up with the rations?
No, I was frightfully proud. I'm particularly proud of the MC because it must have been one of the very first to have been awarded, because that, I can't remember exactly when that particular decoration was instituted, but it was not... It hadn't been in existence very long before I awarded one, and that I was very proud of, because afterwards a great many were given, and well, the feeling was perhaps that they were dished out a little bit.
To take you back to Crowborough, where you were with the training battalion, could you tell me what happened then?
Yes. That would be during the latter half of the 1917 winter. Went down there. I can't remember when it was exactly, but I was there some months or now. I still wasn't A1. I was still in a sort of halfway stage between being active enough to train people, not sufficiently well enough to go on route marches and that kind of thing. But I was getting pretty fed up by that time, because it was a very wearying time in every way. The war had been dragging on for a long time, and I was only too anxious to do something which I thought was could have been a little bit more active. And one day we had a request from the War Office for volunteers, for officers, to volunteer to go to West Africa. And another officer, myself, decided he felt just the same as I did. It would at least be doing something a bit more active and perhaps, I don't know, might be a better thing if we could have got on and done that. So we volunteered, we were accepted, we were given 10 days or fortnight's leave. We got our tropical kit together. I think we got some allowance for it, I hope so. I bet it wasn't enough. And we sailed on the Windsor Castle, I think. It was one of those, the Castle Line, which plied between England and West Africa and South Africa. And anyway, we went on, and we went to Sierra Leone.
Before we actually get to Africa, generally during this period, while you were not A1 and convalescing, I wondered whether you'd care to explore your attitude to the possibility of being passed A1 and posted to the Western Front, and how you react, your thoughts at the time on this whole subject of not being fit enough to go to the Western Front.
Yes, I see what you mean. Well, first of all, we went where we were told. If we were posted anywhere, we went, and that was the end. I was not A1, and at that time, I don't mind admitting, I would not have wanted to go to the Western Front. I'd be quite open about that. I should not have wanted to go. The experience that I'd had at Gallipoli had seared into my mind, and I did realize a little bit what the dangers were and so on. But, as I say, one didn't think about that an awful lot. You simply accepted what came your way. If you were past A1, if you were sent abroad, well, you jolly well went, and that was that. But I quite fairly admit I wasn't anxious for that. So I took what I thought was the next best job by going to a reasonably active thing, as I thought it would be. Anyway, this other officer and I went out there. We disembarked at Sierra Leone at Freetown Harbour, we went up to the barracks, which is Wilberforce Barracks, named after Wilberforce, of course, who got the law passed against slavery. And the barracks up there were named after him. Now, this was the West African Regiment. It consisted of 8 companies, each commanded by a captain, with 1 or 2 lieutenants, I think, to each company, and an English colour sergeant who looked after the accounts, and so on. When we got there, we found that the battalion was on some kind of manoeuvres inland, practicing what they call bush warfare. Anyway, we were sent out to join them. This was some 10 or 12 miles, I suppose, inland. And there we reported to the respective companies, and we joined in the training that was going on. They seemed to think that bush warfare was some particularly intricate form of fighting. Well, the officer and I, I went out with, we really couldn't see any much difference between carrying on warfare in wooded country to any other, anything else. And we reckoned that that's about what we'd been taught all along. Anyway, we joined in this, and they were only there for about another 4 or 5 days. And we occupied ourselves most of the time by trying to avoid getting terribly sunburned. And it was absolutely vital to wear a pith helmet the whole time, of course, and so on. Anyway, we came back to barracks, and we just then carried on our duties, I think, guarding local institutions such as electricity works, I suppose, the water works, the railway stations, and that kind of thing. It was garrison work.
Who were you guarding them from?
Well, we were still at war. Although the German colonies had been subdued in Africa, there was still considerable danger, I suppose, then for perhaps an invasion by some of our enemies. We didn't know. Anyway, that was what we were doing, and it was quite an interesting job. They had two stations up country. One was Mabanta, which is at the head of the Loco River, about 40 miles upstream, I suppose, of the River Loco. And there used to be another one further on still, called Wongafu, which had been closed down because it had been too difficult to find the troops to keep it going. I think that was largely, those stations, I think, were kept largely to help the district commissioners, who were the sort of local justices in the various, because this was a British colony then, and part of our job was to help a district commissioner if he needed the military help over some difficulty with the natives, I suppose. Anyway, I was at Mabanta there for considerable time. There were about a dozen of us there. We had a very happy community. There was one company there at a time. We had a medical officer, and we used to do a certain amount of training, and so on.
How did you get on with your African troops?
Oh, very well. They were a very smart lot. They really were splendid. They had been fighting, I think, in German Southwest Africa. They'd defeated the Germans there. The Germans had surrendered, and they'd come back to Sierra Leone to continue their more or less peacetime duties. But they were a very smart lot. Their drill was magnificent.
Did you speak the language?
No.
You didn't know?
No. The battalion was made up, I should think, of at least a dozen different tribes, mostly of Mendes and Timonies. The Mende were a little, short, thick-set, pugnacious chap. The Mendes were rather more refined type. But there were certainly cannibalism amongst those tribes, and it had in fact happened at Wilberforce Barracks. That had in fact happened. Anyway,
was this while you were there? This?
No, it wasn't. But we were told about this. One of the first things we were told. God, we got there.
What was the story? Do you
well, the story was that some sergeant, it was, in the barracks there, had killed his wife. And she disappeared. And investigation showed that he had been a cannibal, to put it quite bluntly. And that was it. What tribe he belonged to, I don't know. But as I say, there were a large number of tribes. Senegalese, there were some Senegalese, and Swahilis. Those are the only ones I can remember. But their drill and general bearing was very good. Now, some of the old soldiers there, some of the older ones, had actually been to England. Very few had, but some had been to England at the either Queen Victoria's Diamond Jubilee in 1897 or at her funeral. I wouldn't be sure which, but they had been to England, and they had vivid stories to remember this by. They all, of course, spoke pidgin English, which was had been introduced many, many years ago by English traders when they first went there.
Can you tell us a little about your duties assisting a district commissioner at Mabanta?
Well, I don't. I had the only actual request that I ever knew of came from the district commissioner who lived quite close to Mabanta, and apparently one of the natives had suddenly run amok, and he'd been creating havoc amongst some of the population, and I don't know what had happened to him. I don't know. He seemed to have lost his reason, and he was terrifying the natives in one particular area, not very far from our camp, and we were asked if we would deal with it. Well, I got picked on by my company commander to take a party of men that I could choose and go out and see whether I can collar him. Well, I picked the best NCO I knew. I had about 10 or a dozen men. And off we went to where we knew that sort of thing had been going on. And, of course, during the daytime, he would hide up in the bush, and there'd be no trace of him. At night, he used to come out. There were all a tremendous lot of small farms there. The crops were gathered off the farm and left in the farm buildings during after it gathered them at night. And he, of course, came out at night and helped himself to the food. Well, I thought the only thing to do would be to starve him out. So I got the head men of all the villages around where there was food on farms to see that everybody brought their food back into the villages at night and left nothing out of it. And eventually it worked. And he became desperate. And he came out during the day. I think he was set upon by the villagers, first of all, before my men could get there. Anyway, he was killed, and that was the end of him.
And he was killed by the villagers, was he?
Well, I think so. Yes, I think they had either caught him, captured him or something. I think our men probably finished him off because they were all armed with machetes, which are little long-bladed knife. And that was the end of him. But one of his weapons was a horrible sort of dagger-looking thing which he carried about and attacked people without warning. So it was a great relief to all concerned when he was no longer alive.
to give us a sort of picture of the area. Are there any sort of evocative sights, smells, or sounds you can sort of conjure up for us to picture the Africa as you saw it?
Well, all the natives smelt. There's no question about that. Sounds, no, nothing very much, I don't think. We had not a great deal to do, but and we got a fair amount of leave, and we were able to go off for perhaps a couple of 3 days shooting, which we did. And we were very glad of anything we brought back. The bush fowl, which was a bird very similar to a partridge, slightly bigger, that was a very welcome addition to the mess when we came back. Occasionally we'd bathe in the river, which was fairly safe, I think.
What about your social life?
Well, there wasn't anything at all except in our own mess. There were no... The only other European I remember was the local DC. I can't remember his name now, but I used to go to his house sometimes and have a yarn with him and that sort of thing.
Were you aware of the progress of the war in Europe?
Vaguely, vaguely. We did, of course, hear the news of the armistice while I was there. We didn't hear that until 2 days afterwards, when someone came up from Freetown, came up the river bringing stores and that sort of thing to our to the camp, and he brought the news up, and we had quite a celebration. I remember we lit an enormous bonfire. All the troops understood very well what the end of the war meant for them, and they entered into the spirit of the thing very well. But
you were pleased yourself the war was over?
Oh yes, it was a great relief. It was an enormous relief.
You were looking forward to demobilisation?
Very much, oh yes. You see, we'd had 5 years of it. It was terribly wearing. It affected one's outlook all the time. You felt you couldn't do this, you couldn't do that, because there was a war on. And it was a terrific relief. Very soon after that, I got my posting home to England. I'd done them well over the 12 months duty, which tour of duty which I was only supposed to do in that country. I'd done 18 months. And two or three of us went down river that on one evening, and we travelled all night down in this rowing boat, big rowing boat. We all got bitten by mosquitoes. We all got malaria when we were down there. It was pretty virulent too. Anyway, that didn't worry us very much. We knew we were going home, and that was marvellous. And then another option.